Good afternoon. It's Friday, the 12th of April, 2024, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Mike Robinson. Joining me today, we have Debbie Evans and Ben Rubin. And we'll have a couple of special guests later on in the programme. So we look forward to that. Now, we're going to start off with, I guess we could describe this as propaganda. Let's bring on this BBC article that came out yesterday, fake UK stamps blamed on Chinese-made counterfeits. Well, this was the BBC trying to tell us that some criminal activity which is happening in the UK is in fact being done by the Chinese government, effectively. It is China's fault. The author here quoting Ian Duncan Smith as saying, China is behind it. This was a definitive statement. So we've all got to worry about China running economic warfare on the UK. This wasn't the only article on this topic. The Telegraph had one. China behind flood of fake stamps plaguing Britain. And so they said security experts have warned that the mass fraud is economic warfare done with the tacit approval of the Chinese Communist Party. Now, of course, by suggesting that it's tacit approval, what they're basically saying is we have no evidence for this whatsoever. So we're just going to call it tacit approval. This was, I think, actually following an article by Edward Lucas in the Mail. And the headline on this was how China could paralyze Britain and kill thousands by hacking into your electric car, locking you inside and creating deadly traffic jams as cheap Chinese EVs flood Britain. Edward Lucas raises a terrifying possibility. And so let's see what Edward Lucas had to say. He begins with a little story narrative. It's a bitingly cold day in mid-December 2027. China is blockading Taiwan and Britain is poised to join the United States in rallying to the beleaguered island's democracy's defense, a move that would presage World War III. And then comes a brutally blunt message. Every one of the hundreds of thousands of Chinese-made electric cars on UK roads stops dead. Then the pileups begin as other vehicles plow into the suddenly stationary cars. Crippling traffic jams prevent emergency services reaching the scenes of accidents and thousands of injured victims die in agony. The bullies of Beijing have just won a decisive early battle in the struggle for global domination. So this was the type of narrative that Edward Lucas pushing out in the Daily Mail without any critical thought, it seems. But the question is, what is going on here and what are these people up to? Now, to try to understand this, we're going to go back a few years to the Integrity Initiative, and let's just have a quick look at who was involved in that. So we had journalists like Carol Cadwallader here. Edward Lucas, of course, was absolutely part and parcel of Integrity Initiative. We had people like Bill Browder. We had, here's Chris Donnelly, who, of course, was in charge of the Integrity Initiative. Mark Steele also involved. He went on to handle Russiagate and so on. And this group of people, which is much broader than the five on screen at the moment, were running a propaganda campaign called the Integrity Initiative, which was designed to demonize Russia in this case. It looks like they've moved on to China in many ways, but Russia was the situation at that time. And who else was behind, or at least in the background of this organization? It was this man, Richard Dearlove, former head of MI6, otherwise known, at least by me, as Old Yellowcake, because, of course, this is the man whose propaganda brought us to war in Iraq, because it was his bogus intelligence about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq that gave Tony Blair the excuse to go to war in Iraq. But of course, what else was he behind? He was behind various things, not just Russiagate, because he was effectively pulling the strings of Christopher Steele when he produced his report on Russiagate for the US. But he was also behind, indirectly, the whole Sergei Skripal affair, which again designed to generate propaganda against Russia. Now, who was funding this operation? Well, it was the Foreign Office through Andy Price as the head of counter disinformation. But of course, he wasn't just the head of counter disinformation. He was also the head of media development. And of course, this organization claimed to only ever be working abroad. But on the other hand, it was funding the Institute for Statecraft and their Integrity Initiative project here in the UK. So clearly they weren't just working abroad, and they're still not just working abroad. But where they were working abroad was, where one place they were working abroad was Ukraine. And so Andy Price and this organization involved in 2018, in this case, with Ukrainian-British consultations on countering cyber threats. This was held in London and so on. So back at that time, we were very keen to find out a little bit more about this organization, and we put in a Freedom of Information request to the Foreign and Commonwealth Office, as it was then. And it said, I would like to get some background on the role currently held by Andy Price, brackets head of counter disinformation. Could you tell me, please, the scope of the role, the size of the team Andy Price has working with them, and when the role was created? And the response from the Foreign and Commonwealth Office after about 18 months of trying, including the intervention of the Information Commissioner, was, we're not telling you on the grounds of national security. Now, I may be misunderstanding the Freedom of Information Act, but as far as I know, the national security excuse can only be used if you're dealing with intelligence agencies. So I would continue to ask the question, just exactly what kind of operation is the counter disinformation team within the Foreign and Commonwealth Office. But going, sticking at that sort of time period, the person sort of running the show at that time was Mark Sedwill. So if we look at the sort of network that was there at the time, he was head of the National Security Council. He was head of the Cabinet Office. And of course, these two were feeding into the Foreign and Commonwealth Office at the time. Now, I've put the Information Research Department name on there because that was sort of the original counter disinformation team, which was shut down by David Steele, if I remember correct, or may have got that wrong, but it was shut down in the 70s, but it didn't really go away. It sort of stayed there in the background and eventually came back out into the open as the Counter Disinformation and Media Development Program, headed by Andy Price. They funded the Integrity Initiative. Now, Mark Sedwill's gone, of course, and replaced. Andy Price is now gone and replaced. The Integrity Initiative is gone and replaced, and it is in fact replaced with something called the Open Information Partnership, which still exists. It describes itself as a diverse network of established organizations and individuals across Europe working in open, independent, fact-based reporting. Among us are NGOs, charities, academics, think tanks, journalists, fact checkers, and activists. So just think about that. Think about the scale of that, because this was kind of the scale of the Integrity Initiative at the time as well. And so when the Integrity Initiative leaks came out and Carol Cadwallader and Edward Lucas's names were on the list of people working with that organization, the question then is, are they still working with the successor to that organization? Looking at the type of disinformation or the type of stuff that we have seen in the media that came out through that particular infrastructure, this is from a few years ago. Russia spies target coronavirus vaccine, says the BBC. Russia sought to meddle in the UK election, says Dominic Raab. And this is all part of this whole propaganda machine designed to encourage the British public to believe that Russia and China are the threat. Let's just listen to a couple of words from Edward Lucas speaking to The Times.
We are in an existential struggle with Russia, and we can either fight it with Ukraine intact and enthusiastic on our side, or we can wait until Ukraine is beaten and then try and do it on our own. And I fear we're taking the second option at the moment.
So that's just to give an impression of the lunacy that's coming out from these types of circles. And of course, another name that we need to consider here is Tobias Elwood. And he was speaking to Sky News this morning.
We've seen in Ukraine that there are other ways, particularly in the grey zone, that we could be attacked. I'll give an example. It just took one line of code in Heathrow, which was wrong, to bring the entire airport to a closure. That was by accident. So you can see how easy it is to disrupt our way of life, to sow political discord and indeed economic mayhem from afar.
So that's the narrative from Tobias Elwood this morning, sowing discord from afar. And this is absolutely the same narrative that we've been hearing from this group of people for quite some time now. But how do you think Sky News described Tobias Elwood when they introduced him this morning? Let's look at their tweet. Former Defence Minister Tobias Elwood Did they mention that he's a reservist in 77 Brigade? Did they mention or even comment on that or ask him about it or hold him to account and ask, was he giving a genuine opinion or was he propagandizing for the British government at the moment? If you want to know more about that, have a look at this article on the UK Column website. MPs are not entitled to a private public life, which gives a bit of the background to this and a bit of background to Phil Ridley's freedom of information requests on the topic. So what I'm basically saying here is when we look at headlines like fake UK stamps blamed on Chinese-made counterfeits, and we look at headlines on how China could paralyze Britain and kill thousands by hacking into electric cars, we've got to ask ourselves, what are we looking at? And question, you know, should we be heading towards conflict with these countries because the British government already talking about the potential of putting British boots on the ground in Ukraine just for training the Ukrainian troops. So, you know, perhaps cooperation with these countries would be better than conflict. And I'm not suggesting that we shouldn't be judgmental or hold these countries to account for their activities. But at the end of the day, it wasn't China or Russia which caused lockdown or jabs or ULEZ or net zero or censorship or any of the other things. That, you know, Bill Gates is not Chinese. And the NGOs that have been pushing the narratives in this country are not Chinese or Russian. So we've got to think about that and think about just exactly what's been done to us and think about what was done to us during lockdown under the guise of emergency legislation. And if we end up in some kind of level of conflict with these countries, what kind of emergency legislation we might be looking at. So that's that. Ben, over to you. Now, you were in London yesterday at an event.
Absolutely. I was in the beating heart of the British political system, where all of those ne'er-do-wells you've just been talking about like to hang out. I was just around the corner from the Houses of Parliament at the Emanuel Centre last night. Beautiful, beautiful venue. And I was at an event that was being hosted there by an organisation called the Adult Child Health and Environmental Support Group. Acronym is AICS. And the event was called Society, Controlled or Free. Fantastic evening, actually, had by all in attendance, as far as I could tell. It was a really positive night out. It was great. More of this stuff, please. Maybe UK Column should do something. Hey, that's a good idea. So who was there? We had Mark Sharman, the former ITV and Sky News boss, 50-plus year veteran of the British media, who was screening some clips of his new film that he's making about the World Health Organization alongside Oracle Productions. That comes on the back of his other film, Safe and Effective, A Second Opinion, which came out in 2022. It's one of the most senior people in the British media actually out talking about the real stuff right now. So more power to Mark Sharman. Thank you for your work, sir. Looking forward to seeing the film when it comes out. We also saw Sandy Adams, who is a great friend of the column, and she gave a very quick but comprehensive history of technocracy and globalism and the entire globalist agenda, basically, going back to the 1930s, right up to the present day, talking about the key organisations like the Club of Rome, the Rockefeller Foundation, Trilateral Commission, some of the key individuals like Maurice Strong, Dennis Meadows, and basically just outlining the global network of control that's been in development for the past 90 years. And when she presents it, everything just kind of clicks together. She's got all the information. She's done a fantastic job. She told a really, you know, interesting story about waking up in the early 2000s while she was working directly with Microsoft and Google and beginning to understand their agenda for smart cities and the whole digital control grid that they're building. Sandy, thank you. It was a really great presentation. Also there, we had Tess Laurie from the World Council for Health, who are doing fantastic things. Making some astonishing progress, actually. They've actually established national health councils in over 30 countries now, so they're actually up and running. She gave a brilliant update on the work that they've been doing. A few really just very kind of nourishing takeaways. You know, she's got a really great way about her, Tess, and there are a few bits of advice. One was to be a warrior, not a worrier. Yeah, a warrior, like you fight, rather than a warrior who just worries. I really like that. And the idea that you have to create your way out of tyranny, you can't just wait for someone to come along and sort it out for you. It's on us to create our way out of tyranny. And actually, we have the opportunity to build something great for ourselves and for our children. Really optimistic message. Thank you, Tess, for coming along. That was a great presentation. Also, this gentleman, W. Scott McCullough from Children's Health Defence, who I think we've probably done some work with. I know that there was a UK column symposium, I believe, a year or two ago, talking about electromagnetic frequencies, 5G, and the kind of digital control grid. And I would imagine that Mr. McCullough would have been involved in that because he's very senior at Children's Health Defence. He's their main kind of outside advisor on legal issues. Really, really, really solid and impressive fella. I mean, his speech was fantastic. He used the term controligarchs, which I really liked, and basically explained in extraordinary detail how this digital control system works, the dangers of electromagnetic frequencies, and also his solution to getting away from the control grid is to put the devices down and get a life, right? Which got a massive round of applause, and I think that that's really good advice that we can all live by. A lot of discussion about the dangers of these systems that they're bringing in. So there was talk of the ULEZ cameras, and you may have seen this graphic doing the rounds, the idea that they're called C-46's extermination weapons, multi-fusion photon ionization radiation guns. Right, I'm not sure. I don't actually quite understand what all of those words mean when they're strung together like that, but I am certainly suspicious of all of the hardware that's being put up around our cities. And I think that you should be too. And then the kind of blockbuster showstopper at the end of the evening, Andrew Bridgen, who seems to be becoming something of a folk hero, actually. He received an incredibly warm reception. He delivered a very well-polished speech, actually. Some of the jokes have clearly been rolled out a few times now, actually. But we can forgive him that, I think. He was described as Churchillian. And in fact, someone was suggesting that maybe he should have a statue on Parliament Square. I'm not sure if we're quite there yet, but we'll see how the next year or two goes. And I've got a little clip here of Bridgen speaking in the Q&A session at the end about his views on youth and how to reach out to them. There's a lot of people in the movement are very clearly concerned about that.
A problem. They have had the full indoctrination in the schools for the last 3 decades, and also nearly half of them have been to university and had another dose of indoctrination. When I first spoke out and got, well, probably about 200,000 emails over a few months from around the world, it was amazing that the average age of the person who contacted me was probably in their late 50s or early 60s, and there were plenty of emails from 85-year-olds who could see what was going on. We're going to have to be patient with the young. They have had the full indoctrination, and they will be the last to wake up. And I think there's a wider message. We have to be gentle to an extent with those who've not woken up yet. It's a bit like I can drag someone to church and make them listen to a sermon, but I can't make them believe in God. And until the people are ready, all we can do is lay out the ground and the information for them, and in their own time, they will come. But in the meantime, we've got to act, because we're the ones who know what's going on, and we've got to stop it.
I think that's pretty solid advice, actually. We've got to lay the groundwork. We've got to build community around the issues, actually. And the most heartening thing of the entire evening was meeting people, speaking to people, hearing about what they were doing. I've got a couple of examples of some of the leaflets that were being shared. So this here from the National Residents Association, if we can flip over onto the back, they've done this fantastic visual showing, you know, what is a smart city? What are the different components of it? What are the dangers? And actually, wouldn't we just prefer having something which isn't smart and is more traditional? And I certainly would agree with that. And then finally, I had the chance to meet one of the people involved in organising Stand Together, who are focused on local action, waking up the masses, providing an alternative to the mainstream narrative. And they're really, really big on community outreach. And they've got an event coming up this Sunday, 14th of April, starting at midday at Grove Park in Castleton in South London. So if you're in the area, make sure to go down and check it out. And I think that this is very much the direction of travel that we need to take, community outreach and building things back up from the ground up.
Couldn't agree more. Thank you very much, Ben. Thank you for that. And thank you for going to that that event. Debbie, welcome to the programme. And let's have a look at what the MHRA has been up to.
Well, yes, good afternoon, everyone. And should I say good afternoon to the MHRA as well, because I'm sure they're watching, or at least somebody's watching. But I've had difficulty this time with the MHRA. I'm feeling like a bit of a nag, actually, because I've had to email them to ask for tickets, and then there was no facility to ask questions on the board meeting prior to the board meeting. And then it was, well, where's the YouTube? So I emailed them this week because it's nearly a month since the board meeting. And thank you to everybody at the MHRA for facilitating the YouTube on the next day. So we have it now. Here's a screenshot just to show you. Please go and have a look at it. Even if you just click in, it shows that we're watching them quite clearly. So let's look at what they said. I've just snatched a little bit from some of the board meeting, but I want to talk about the yellow card biobank. Now, this is pioneering genetic engineering, genetic genomic sequencing. And you can see the press release. This was released in February, pioneering genetic biobank to start recruiting patients on stroke prevention medicines. And this is the yellow card biobank. Now, let's just go to the next slide to see our friend, Dr. June Rain, or should we say Dame June Rain, who says, "We are excited to launch the second phase of the yellow card biobank, which demonstrates that we are at the absolute forefront of innovation in the field of drug safety monitoring. Almost a third of adverse reactions to medicines could be prevented with the introduction of genetic testing. The Yellow Card Biobank will help us move forward towards our goal of personalized medicine. Getting involved with this important initiative means you will help more people use medicines safely." Now, I just want to add very quickly that if anybody is watching that has had an adverse reaction to anything, it is likely that they may be asked to volunteer themselves to the Yellow Card Biobank. Now, this is because of personalized medicine. They want to experiment and investigate you. They're not there to help you. They're there to grab the data from your adverse reactions and then pass it on to researchers. And I just want to say that the Yellow Card is the flagship of the MHRA. It's patient safety. And they say that genetics play a very important part in minimizing drug adverse reactions. Now, the chief safety officer, of course, we know as Dr. Alison Cave, who's sitting very nicely earning £195,000 a year. She's the highest earner of the MHRA. She was talking about the Yellow Card Biobank at the board meeting. Let's have a listen.
I think, Alison, you're up next and going to update us on the Yellow Card Biobank.
So for those online, the aim of the Yellow Card Biobank is to better understand how a patient's genetic makeup can impact the safety of their medicines and more specifically the incidence of side effects to those medicines. And we feel that understanding the underlying mechanism of adverse reaction would support the development of new testing, pharmacogenomic testing strategies to reduce the burden of public health burden of ADRs and also, of course, the personal burden on an individual. So that's the vision of the biobank. We have a two-year pilot, which we launched last year, and we're now at the midpoint of that pilot. So during the first year, as the paper sets out, we've established and recruited an excellent team. We've established a formal memorandum of understanding with Genomics England, our partner in this pilot, a formal governance structure, including a steering board, a scientific advisory board, a project board, and a patient and public involvement Management Advisory Group. We've finalised a procurement contract for the blood collection, and we've launched two pilot topics. One is allopurinol and Stephen Johnson syndrome, which is a very severe skin reaction. And the second is DOACs, which is direct acting oral anticoagulants and severe bleeding. Those two topics have been carefully chosen to answer different questions through this pilot. The first, allopurinol and SGS, has a known variant already identified, and what we want to look at is, can the biobank identify this variant and potentially look at other variants which might influence this reaction? And the second, the DOACs, direct acting oral anticoagulants and severe bleeding, less certainty whether there's a genomic variant underlying that. But what we're looking at is, through the biobank and a more discovery phase project, can we identify a variant which may increase the risk of this particular adverse reaction?
So there you see, the biobank is not for patients, it's for the MHRA and for research. Now, if I could just ask the gallery at this point, if we could, I've got two clips from Liz Booth, the People's Officer, one that will show in extra, number two. So if we can jump to the number three video in a minute, I'd be grateful. Because Liz Booth, I'd like you to meet her. She's only been appointed 6 months. She's the People's Officer, and she looks after the MHRA's people. She was talking about the fact that it's not all happy clappy in the MHRA. The people that work in the MHRA are far from happy. In fact, they feel bullied and harassed. Please go and look at the whole snippet. But for now, we asked them about the reward system. What do people get as a reward if they're so depressed and they're leaving in droves the MHRA? What do you do to keep morale up? Have a little listen.
And Liz, you mentioned reward and recognition vouchers, and there were a couple of questions which summarised are, what are the reward vouchers, how much is a voucher for, and what are they awarded for? So a little bit more on that would be helpful.
Certainly. I like to think of the reward vouchers as the virtual bunch of flowers. So the amounts are £50 and £100. There are tax implications to that, which our colleagues in finance have happily dealt with for us. They're classically given quite quickly after some wonderful piece of work has happened. So managers and colleagues are able to nominate people. There is, of course, a moderation of that to make sure that the work hasn't been rewarded more than once. But the key thing about these vouchers is not the value of the voucher, it's the value of the recognition. So I like to think of them as virtual flowers or a virtual box of chocolates.
So there you have the reward scheme. More to come in extra on that.
I feel the need to go and work for the MHRA straight away on the basis of that. Thank you, Debbie. Okay, if you like what the UK Column does, you'd like to support us, all the options for helping us out are on support.ukcolumn.org, and we do need your help. We only do this with your support, so thank you very much to everybody that is doing that for us. Please share anything you find on the platforms, especially ukcolumn.org and ukcolumnextracts.co.uk. And don't forget, the shop is there if you'd like to pick up a hoodie or a hat or a water bottle and a number of other items there. Now, Ben, yesterday we put out the interview that you did with Professor David Barnheiser. That's now up on the website. Just give us a brief overview.
Absolutely. If you'd like to understand why anyone who's university educated under the age of about 35 hates their own history and culture, then go and watch this interview.
Brilliant. Thank you. And Debbie, your blog is up.
It is indeed jam-packed this week with all that you see on there and more. And also, if you've ever suffered from a urinary tract infection, don't worry, there's a vaccine heading your way very soon.
Excellent. That's good news. We want to highlight once again the Glasgow Freedom Rally taking place in George Square, Glasgow, 1 p.m. on Saturday. That's tomorrow. And so that's all about exiting the WHO and what people can do to organise around that idea. Another reminder of the Sounds Beautiful Festival taking place in Wimborne in Dorset, June 27th to the 30th. If you didn't see Wednesday's extra, then please go and have a look at that, because there are more details about this event on there. And then also Stand in the Light, that is taking place in Cumbria in May. We'll have somebody on to talk about that, I believe, on Wednesday's extra next week. So looking forward to that as well. Now, Ben, let's come back to you. And, well, Lord Bethnal.
Yes, my noble and gracious Lord Bethnal has taken to the internet to express some concerns. He says that the health and benefits announcement this week have been uncomfortable for many of us. However, denying the reality of the situation will only exacerbate the issue. It's time to face the facts. A significant portion of the British population is too physically and mentally unwell to maintain employment. Some may never be able to return to work. Let's hear him talking about this with Times Radio.
I think that we need to abandon this collective denial. I think the government needs to look really closely at these figures and accept the fact that there's a huge amount of genuine physical illness in the country, and hundreds of thousands, millions of people are just too sick to work, and they are not just sick, they're sick and fed up. The really striking number is that the average number of morbidities is three. In other words, people have three things wrong with them, not just one. These aren't people who are just feeling a bit grumpy and can't get out of bed to go to work. These people are carrying significant illness and in addition have got mental health problems, which is very common if you're ill.
So we're sick as a nation. We have more than 3 million people on personal independence payments now, which is what's replaced disability living allowance, right? These are people who are permanently signed off sick. It's about 10% of the entire workforce. Just think about that. That's an absolutely staggering figure. There's some analysis of these figures from Ed Dowd over on Twitter, which show a 76.7% increase in new claims in 2022 and 69.1% in 2023. So these numbers are going up quite significantly.
Ben, just before we move on, if we just put that graph back on screen, is it a coincidence that this stuff started in 2021?
Well, probably not. And I think that's really the issue at hand, isn't it?
Right? Yes.
And a lot of this stuff's really bad, yeah? Because we're talking about serious, serious injuries to people. It's not just, you know, I can't quite get out of bed or I'm a little bit down in the dumps, so you've got to sign me off work. We're talking about nervous system damage, right? So actually one of the most striking increases is, as we can see on this next chart, is the new neuropathy claims are up 680% as of October 2023. And they started to rise in 2021, and we all know what started in 2021. And Lord Bethnal is absolutely right to be concerned about this, but probably not for the reason that he's communicating to us, because Lord Bethnal is a noble lord. He sits in the upper chamber of the British political system, and he is one of the most senior health ministers in the government, or he certainly was until very recently. But during the COVID years, he was personally responsible for all COVID procurement, so he oversaw that personally. And he also had ministerial responsibility for the development of the new vaccines, working in close collaboration with the pharmaceutical industry. The question is he trying to clean up his mess? Actually, I don't think that he is. Actually, because this appears to be a ruse to roll out the next wave of their plan. So he's just issued this document last week, I believe, or maybe the week before. Health is wealth, a fast start for a covenant for health. They really want to get going on this, authored by, amongst others, Bethnal, but also David Halpin, yes, from the Behavioural Insights team, who is also very closely involved in coercing the entire nation into participating in a medical experiment. And what do they want to do? Well, it's all about preemptive healthcare, preventative healthcare. And they say we must optimize the potential of big data, database segmentation, diagnostic tools, and genomics to identify, target, and intervene earlier in order to keep people healthier, right? So this is all part of the same technological paradigm that got us into this mess in the first place.
Indeed. And the question is, where are they going to get all the data for this big data that they want to talk about? And of course, our data, our personal data, is protected by the Data Protection Act. Or is it? Because in the very near future, it's not going to be anymore, as we'll come on to in a second. But the first thing I want to say about the Data Protection Act is my argument has been, for as long as I can remember, that the Data Protection Act actually was never about protecting our personal information. It was about creating a register of databases so that at some point in the future, since it was established, whoever wanted to get access to data knew where they could go to get access to particular data. And we would start to see databases being merged when it was convenient. So it should come perhaps as no surprise then that the government has issued this. This is all about combining vehicle data creates safer roads. Police says the government need to be able to identify the most high-risk vehicles on the roads, those which are uninsured or which do not have a valid MOT or vehicle tax. But this data is held by separate organisations and is not easily cross-referenced. So they say National Policing Initiative Operation Tutelage compares automatic number plate recognition data with information from the motor insurance database to identify drivers who do not have insurance. Tutelage Plus checks whether vehicles have valid MOT certificate and whether vehicle excise duty has been paid through checks against DVSA and DVLA databases. So they're starting to merge these databases together and be able to query these databases at the same time. Now, this might seem like a reasonably minor issue in terms of road traffic incidents, but of course, this is only the beginning. This kind of thing we're going to see spreading right across government. The question is, who's behind this? The answer is this lot. So this is the ACE, powered by Vivius. Let's have a look and see who this is. Oh, just before we do, we should mention that the Accelerated Capability Environment, ACE, is already in bed with Ofcom over online safety and censorship and so on. And in fact, this little project, this little organization, which is big, part of a much bigger organization, as we'll see in a second, is into all kinds of areas of government at the moment. So merging the databases for driving offenses is just one of the aspects of this. But who is behind the Accelerated Capability Environment? Well, it's Kinetic, which of course is a defense contractor. So we're now into defense, looking at our personal data, managing our personal databases, and so on. So this is a Vivius framework. Let's see what they have to say about this. The Accelerated Capability Environment solves rapidly changing digital challenges facing law enforcement and national security agencies. So let's bring the spooks in as well. We bring together expertise from industry and academia to innovate collaboratively and create mission impact at pace, typically weeks and months rather than months and years, typical of large delivery programs. And of course, you might say that there are parallels to vaccine development with this type of thing, because we're all into making sure things are only taking weeks or months rather than months or years these days. We are a home office capability within the Homeland Security Group that was founded in March 2017 with an initial priority of helping solve frontline challenges in areas of communications data and lawful intercept. Now, I don't know how many people are even aware that the UK has a Homeland Security Group. But now you are. So that's that part of it. But then we have new data protection legislation, or data removal of protection legislation, on its way. We've talked about this before, but let's just bring you up to date with it. This is the Data Protection and Digital Information Bill, and that's currently in the House of Lords at the committee stage. And so it's well through its progress through Parliament. And what's this all about? This is all about enabling AI. That is what this is about 100%. So let's just look at the various aspects of this. So first of all, this legislation provides a wider scope for public authorities to refuse subject access requests. So if you believe that your data has been used inappropriately, this particular legislation will make it much more difficult for us to find out how our data has been used by public authorities, and they'll have much more scope for refusal for giving that information out. It enables solely automated decision-making. So this is AI into the public sector, making sure that agencies, whether that be HMRC or whomever, are making automated decisions. Perhaps this is heading into the courts as well. We know that AI is heading into the courts, but this legislation enables that. Lesser requirement for a proper impact assessment. So the current data protection regime is saying that any kind of use of data needs to be necessary and it needs to be proportionate. And this legislation removes that protection in many ways. It enables international transfers of personal data because many of these large AI companies are international, of course. And so our personal data, which can't currently be exported to the United States, for example, will be able to be exported to the United States under this legislation. But this is, again, the most worrying aspect of this. It gives the Secretary of State broad powers to amend data protection laws via statutory instruments. So again, we have secondary legislation being used to basically, within the primary legislation, it becomes an enabling act that allows the Secretary of State to do whatever the heck he likes in the future. This is extremely dangerous, and this whole data protection regime needs to be dealt with. It's not too late still. It's still only in the House of Lords. It is a committee stage. There's still opportunity to stop it if we get organised around that. So keep an eye on this. Ben, let's come back to you then for, well, what's Channel One? Could this be more AI-related stuff?
Everything's AI related these days, I think. Yes, I introduced Channel One back in December. It's a new media organisation, and let's find a little bit out about what they're about.
Hello, and welcome to Channel One, a new way of consuming, reporting, and thinking about the news powered by artificial intelligence. Today, you'll witness AI-generated stories and headlines, captivating visuals and data-driven insights. From global news to finance to entertainment, we'll show you how technology enables us to bring you a global perspective 24/7, right from the heart of our AI-native newsroom. All presented by our team of AI-generated reporters.
Maybe you hear the words artificial intelligence and you're immediately skeptical or concerned about technology gone crazy. But everything you'll see on Channel One relies on trusted sources and fact-checking and uses AI to give you news the way you want it, personalized, localized, and distilled. Through it all, our mission is to provide you with accurate, unbiased, and trustworthy news. Technology may be the tool, but journalism's core values of integrity and accountability are at the heart of everything we do.
Accurate, unbiased, integrity, fact-checked. Sounds fantastic, doesn't it? That got a huge amount of coverage when it launched back in December. We can see here the chief executive, Adam Mosem, who's based out of the Bahamas. I've actually been thinking to myself this morning, like, is this guy even real? Or is this an AI bot on LinkedIn? It's entirely possible that it is, you know, right? So anyway, he was talking back in December about how exciting the launch was. We could just click on. We can see here saying that they got 5 million impressions on Twitter. Elon even dropped by to comment on the launch. Loads of mainstream media coverage. They had 5,000 inquiries come in. And then this week, they've reared their head again. So this has now been activated. Yeah, they teed it up. 4 months down the line, it's now been activated. And it caught my attention yesterday because they just launched 14 new films in various different languages. They've got English, German, Korean, Japanese, like the whole, it's a global launch, essentially, that they've put out. And it's this guy, Adam Mosem, who is the founder, talking about what their plans are for this year.
Hello, everyone. We at Channel One are humbled by the positive response we've received after millions of viewers across the globe saw what we're working on. Today, we'll give you more details about what we hope will be the start of a new chapter in journalism and global communication. We have all heard that the news industry is in a state of crisis. Facing decreasing audiences and intense economic pressure, many respected brands that have been around for generations are now struggling to stay afloat. In an attempt to maintain their audience, some outlets have resorted to telling people only what they want to hear, confirming their biases, and reinforcing their worldview. This dangerous loop leads to polarization, and we're now seeing the effects of this in our society. In some extreme cases, we've seen our news providers deliberately cross the boundary of truth into knowing falsehood to preserve their narrative. As a result, trust in our institutions is at an all-time recorded low. We must get to a place where we can at least have a set of shared facts, separate the opinion, and understand the difference. Only then can we have meaningful debates and conversations about our society. It's time for a reinvention.
So, I mean, everything that he says that he's trying to fix, I think, well, he'll end up doing the opposite. And I think that's probably the point with this stuff, right? So he just said in the piece there that things are becoming more polarized. It's difficult to have conversations across different ideological lines. And that we don't have a set of shared facts that we can all agree on. Now, in the first video that I just showed, they talked about total personalization of your newsfeed based on you as an individual, right? And they're actually going to construct narratives, construct headlines, construct content based on your individual perspective, which is the complete opposite to us having a shared understanding of what's going on. So this organization is fascinating. I think that now that they have been activated with this launch, we're going to see a lot more of them. But I think that the aim of this appears to be to sow as much discord and confusion and chaos as possible. And I'll be keeping a very close eye on them.
Yes, thanks, Ben. And just to finish this segment off then, let's look at this little bit of video that the British government was pushing out today, because the second AI safety summit is going to take place in Seoul on the 21st and the 22nd of May. Well, they say that the summit will spearhead discussions on AI safety, addressing the potential capabilities of the most advanced AI models, building on the Bletchley Declaration and wider agreements, which were agreed at the AI safety summit in the UK last November. Which included commitments from developers on AI safety. So that's taking place in the coming days. We will, or at least next month. So we will tell you more about that closer to the time. But, you know, of course, as we've described all the way through this program, this really is a veneer of safety on top of a pretty unpleasant regime that's on its way. So we'll leave that there for now. Debbie, over to you and introduce a couple of special guests, because we have Professor Norman Fenton and Cheryl Granger with us.
We do indeed. And thank you so much for this, because the MHRA, here we are going back to the MHRA again, the MHRA meets finally the Information Commissioner's Office. And the question is how important is the health of pregnant women and our unborn babies, bearing in mind that we know all the dangers of COVID? And Cheryl has forever seemingly been trying to get some data from the MHRA, because she knows that the MHRA have got very valuable data. But let me introduce Cheryl, because Cheryl's information has also made Professor Norman Fenton's attention. So Cheryl, welcome to UK Column. Thank you so much. You have been trying to get this data, vital data, from the MHRA for a long time. Tell us a bit more about where you're at now.
Thanks, Debbie. Hello, everybody. Yes, I have. It was all your fault, Debbie, because you got me to listen to the All Wales Therapeutic Toxicology Centre presentation that June Rain, bless her, did in the 17th of November 2022. And there she talked about this yellow card monitor. So my ears pricked up, because she was talking about the information that it would be able to give us on pregnancy, because she had about 2,000 pregnant women, and she was very pleased with the fact that she had a denominator, so she'd be able to work out percentages and what have you. So because of that, I wanted to see the monitor. So I wrote my Freedom of Information request, and I asked lots of questions about what the monitor was reporting on. I wanted to know about how they were monitored and which trimester of the pregnancy the vaccination was given. I wanted to talk about miscarriage levels and stillbirths and spontaneous abortions. Did they record any? How many went to full term? Congenital malformations? Any serious adverse events that they were reporting, and then to go on to breastfeeding facts that came out of the monitor. And my final question was, did this cohort of pregnant women influence the MHRA's risk-benefit analysis? which they keep telling us about. So I did the Freedom of Information, and I basically got a Section 22 refusal, which means that they're holding back information with a view to its future publication, with no mention as to how long it was going to take to publish. And they stated, "We do not consider that the public interest is best served by releasing the information to you ahead of its formal presentation." So they wanted to develop a scientific publication that had been peer-reviewed, and they said, by a bit more questioning, that they were going to do it at the end of 23, early 24. Well, obviously, that's been and gone. So we're now wondering when this is going to happen, if at all. With that refusal, I also was given a interim report. So this is the MHRA going to one of their committees, the Pharmacovigilance Expert Advisory Group. They always have wonderful names, don't they? And they basically were presented the information from the monitor within the interim report that they let us have. So it was basic data. And they did that in July 21. So that was quite early on. And the group didn't decide that they were going to publish this information so that they could stop any harm coming to pregnant ladies. And it was about the time that the monitor was stopped, because it only ran for about 7 months. So was that on the advice of the group to stop getting any more information on pregnancy? We don't know. The summary product characteristics actually still states that there were no vaccine-related effects on female fertility, pregnancy, and embryo and fetal or offspring development. So it still states that. So when I was refused, I went back and asked for an internal review. And, of course, the MHRA reviews themselves. It met its obligation in handling the Freedom of Information request, and Section 22 was correctly applied, was what they concluded. And then the only thing I could do then was go and do a challenge through the ICO, and we got their response the other day. But that was sent off on the 24th of November, which obviously meant that they'd taken a long time to come back to us. So I'd really like to remind everybody about the results that this interim report has actually produced, and ask Norman to go through that for me.
Yeah. Okay. Can you hear me okay?
We can hear you, Norman. Can we see you? Yes, you're there. Hello, Norman. Welcome to the column. Thank you so much. I'm absolutely delighted you can join us. And for people that aren't aware, let's just remind people, Professor Norman Fenton, Emeritus Professor of Risk, Queen Mary University of London. And I'd just like to direct people to Professor Fenton's Substack there. And this is the latest entry, the one that Cheryl is referring to. The MHRA still won't release critical data on vaccinated pregnant women. So yes, Professor Fenton, please take it away. And Cheryl, please ask questions when you need to.
Thank you.
Yeah, so the thing about that yellow card vaccine monitor system that they set up when the vaccines were rolled out was that, unlike the normal yellow card, this was an active response system. So they were, the people who signed up for this were expected to report adverse events. So yeah, you might get a few more reports than you would otherwise get from most people. But the shocking thing was that I think it was something like 25,000 people signed up, of whom, as Cheryl said, I think it was a bit less than 2,000, but somewhere in that region of 2,000 pregnant women. Remarkably, over 53% of all of the people reported at least one adverse reaction within those first few months, which is an astonishing figure. And of the pregnant women, 66% of those who actually had the AstraZeneca vaccine reported at least one adverse reaction. I think it was a 61% for Moderna, 38% for Pfizer. We're talking about in that short period when it was active. And of course, we don't know what actually happened, but Cheryl said, they must have been pretty worried anyway about these data, because the way they sent it off to these, you know, there's the safety analysis experts at this, whatever it was, this pharmacovigilance group. And then, as Cheryl said, then it stopped. We didn't, you know, they kind of like, there must have been some safety signals here, but they never provided anything more than this very, very basic data, which simply indicated that there must have been some kind of a safety signal with those kinds of high proportions of adverse reactions being reported. And what's kind of like remarkable is this whole exemption, this excuse that they're able to use to enable them not to publish the results that they clearly have, the detailed results, they're planning to submit a peer reviewed paper, right? So as Cheryl said, they that was supposed to be done at the end of 2023, beginning of 2024. It hasn't happened. But the point is, what does it even mean? Because they're saying that they're only going to publish it as a peer reviewed paper. Well, if you want to get a peer reviewed paper rejected, all you have to do is write it up very badly and it won't get accepted. So if they submit it to a journal, they can say, well, we prepared this paper, but it didn't get accepted. Does that then allow them never to report these results? Or does it then mean that they're expected to go on forever until they some point in the future get it into a form which is fit for, which actually passes peer review? We've got no idea, right? I mean, I have no confidence in the peer review process whatsoever, but what we do know about it is that papers that have challenged, that have, let's say, challenged the safe and effective COVID narrative, have found it very, very difficult to get peer reviewed, even if they're very well written. Whereas papers that support the narrative, you know, that, oh, it's safe and effective, you know, using all the tricky techniques, you know, the cheap trick techniques that we reported on, which massively exaggerate the safety and efficacy of the vaccines, those get fast tracked into peer reviewed papers. So, you know, what's going on here? I mean, if it's if it really is presenting some negative results, it's not going to even pass peer review. So it'll never, you know, if there are safety signals there, it won't even get it won't get accepted in the major journals.
It appears to me, Norman, as though it's a get out of jail free card for the MHRA and that they might never release the data. Cheryl, can I bring you in for a comment here, please? And perhaps you'd like to address this with Norman.
Yeah, I mean, we're saying, or they're saying, Norman, that it's because it's a novel technology methodology. So my question is it because you've got VSafe in America and I presume you've got these sorts of things being done in different areas, and that's why they're saying it needs a peer review? Do these data sets normally get peer reviewed?
No, there's no justification for this whatsoever. But I'll tell you something else that's incredibly relevant to this, which, fun enough, I also did a story about last week because it is really related to this. It's the story of UKHSA and the way they handle the pregnancy data from the safety data from the vaccines in pregnancy. So UKHSA is UK Health Security Agency, and I reported back in 2022. I found that they were basically, there's no other word for it, they were scamming the public with their reports on the data. So they were basically producing a report. Their report was supposed to produce information comparing bad outcomes from pregnancy. So these would be things like miscarriages and stillbirths, between the vaccinated and the unvaccinated pregnant women, right? Which is exactly what we're interested in. We want to know the difference. And they were effectively claiming, well, there isn't any difference, therefore there is absolutely no safety signal here, right? But you know what they did? It's quite incredible. They were classifying all women who got the vaccine prior to pregnancy, even if it was one day prior to them getting pregnant. They were put in the bucket with the unvaccinated. So it wasn't unvaccinated against vaccinated they were doing. It was the unvaccinated and those vaccinated but pre-pregnancy who were compared with those vaccinated during pregnancy. And this was completely outrageous. And the reason why, it just so happened that a couple of weeks after that, Laura Kenny, who was the formerly Laura Trott, the, you know, Britain's greatest ever female athlete, winner of 5 gold medals, cyclist and who'd last won gold at the Tokyo Olympics in 2021. She came out publicly saying that in November of 2021, she had a miscarriage, and that was a miscarriage, nine-week miscarriage. So that she'd got pregnant after the Olympics, we know that. And then in January of 2022, she had ectopic pregnancy. Now, I don't know whether, I'm not saying that these are caused by the vaccine, but what we certainly do know, and this was what, and we know it now for sure now, which is why I updated it after she announced her her retirement a couple of weeks ago, she definitely had two. She was fully dosed. She got two doses of the COVID vaccine prior to those Olympics. And how do we know that? Because whereas it wasn't mandatory for all athletes to be vaccinated to get to Tokyo Olympics, it was mandatory for all British athletes. Asia mandated it. So we absolutely know that she was vaccinated shortly before going to Tokyo. And we absolutely know that she had a miscarriage and an ectopic pregnancy after she had been vaccinated, but not during pregnancy. And that means, or at least almost certainly, she didn't get it during pregnancy, she got it just before. That means those two bad outcomes of Laura Kenny would have been classified and recorded in that UK HSA data with the bucket of the unvaccinated. And this is the kind of scam that we're up against an enormous obfuscation of. It's not just that they're not telling us the full data, they're obfuscating the data they do have.
Professor Fenton, I think I have to say, just to finish this segment up, because we're running out of time, thank you so much. But I think we have to say that we absolutely know that the MHRA have the data and we must see it. So keep tuned, because there's going to be very much more on this in the near future. Thank you both very much indeed.
Yes, thank you very much to Cheryl Granger and Professor Norman Fenton, and to Debbie and to Ben for today's programme. Thank you all for watching. We will be back in a few minutes if you're a UK Column member for some extra. But otherwise, have a great weekend. We'll see you on Monday and we'll see you then. Bye-bye.